I mean, that might seem a little strange because, of course, the only reason we care about the model is how it's going to work in the future, which is obviously unseen data. But if you only cared about how the model worked on data you could see, you wouldn't need statistics or machine learning or anything like that. There's a very simple model that does the best possible job on your historical data. Does anyone know what it is? Yeah. Well, right, a lookup table. Right. You simply look up what the historical, for whatever level of detail you want to drill down into, you look up what happened historically. Well, what happens if you do that? So let's say you had a very small homeowner's book. So the results are kind of noisy. So you're looking at construction type versus, you know, low limit, you know, up to high limit policies. Yeah, you can see this is just kind of, you can see there's some patterns there where, you know, the higher limit policies look like they're costing more than the lower limit policies, and generally speaking, for the same limit, wood is worse than the other construction types. But, you know, you wouldn't want to pick out each cell and say, well, the medium low limits, wood's really, really good. So, in fact, this was the motivation, 50 years ago now, why Bailey came up with Bailey's method. You know, don't, you know, constrain yourself to assume that you've got the same relativities for the different construction types, you know, across all levels of amount of insurance. Maybe later you can come back to revisit that, you know, if you think your data is sufficiently rich, but you don't want to start out with a lookup table. It doesn't really do you much good. And nowadays, when we've got, you know, hundreds of possible variables we can look at, if you really did a lookup table, you know, you'd be looking up individual policies. Or, you know, you might be looking up empty cells, which would really do you no good. So the problem, the basic problem is, you can build a model that fits the data you've seen, but it doesn't generalize because it's fit noise rather than signal. So the biggest problem we have is that they don't teach model validation very well in school. They don't teach it very well in the actuarial exams. So until people start working, they haven't really learned that they need to do this. And part of that is because a lot of the techniques they learn in school, linear regression in a single variable, well, in theory, you ought to do model validation even in that simple a case. You know, in practice, it's often not going to matter that much. When you start using fancier methods, you know, multiple linear regression where you've got a lot of predictor variables. And by the way, I don't even mention GLMs here because the search by hand, automated feature searches, splines, you know, those three levels sort of all apply to multiple linear regression or to GLMs equally. If you just search a few models by hand, neither a linear regression nor a GLM is all that dangerous. You start doing things like stepwise, you're searching more models, so it gets more dangerous. When you start introducing things like splines or a lot of interaction terms, it gets very, very dangerous that you're overfitting. Some of the things that can really go wrong. A guy who worked for me was working on an auto rating plan. And he was using some fairly adaptive methods, essentially generalized additive models, for age. And so he had a separate age curve, you know, curve of age relativities for male drivers and for female drivers. You know, basically for the younger ages, you know, male drivers were more expensive than female drivers, as you'd expect. You know, for middle-aged folks, it was essentially the same, no statistically significant difference, which was roughly what I would have expected. But then for drivers that were like older than, I think it was something like 70 or 75 years, he had that female drivers were more expensive than male drivers. And I said, well, you know, there's not a whole lot of data out there. And he said, well, that's what the numbers said. So I decided, well, you know, this isn't the final model. He's you know, he's going to go back and try some other things. I didn't really object too much because I figured I could veto it later. So the next day he comes back, he's tweaked some other things in the model, and he still has these separate curves for older drivers for male and female. Only now the male drivers are more expensive. And he didn't even notice that. So I said, yeah, you sure you still want separate curves for old male and old female drivers? And he looked at me like, what are you talking about? And I said, well, take a look at who's more expensive now. And then he realized that maybe the model was a little overfit. So you need to be fairly agnostic when you get things that don't make sense. Some of these adaptive techniques you have to be very careful about. So, for example, how many of you have heard of boosting? So boosting is something that's used in a lot of machine learning applications where you fit a model, and then you look at the observations where the model didn't fit particularly well, and you refit the model giving more weight to those observations so that the model will fit them better. And then at the end, you have to go back and take an average of this whole series of models you've created. But essentially, you're focusing in on the cases the model didn't fit well. Now, if you're trying to teach a robot pattern recognition, or if you're trying to teach a second grader how to do his spelling words, this makes a lot of sense. It's harder to learn the exceptions than the rule. But that's a very dangerous method with a lot of insurance data because the exceptions tend to be noise. They don't tend to be something you want to read anything into. So that's why the adaptive methods you have to be a little bit careful about. I guess the other thing I want to say is in school you learn a lot of tests with the data that you built your model on. And those kind of work for really, really simple models. And I emphasize kind of, because there's always been some sort of model search that you've done that invalidates them. They don't work at all for more complicated models, and I'll get into some of the reasons for that. So this is, even for the things that are relatively low on the danger scale, it just means you should have more confidence that the model will validate well, but that doesn't mean that it will, so you always need to do the check. So how do you display data? How do you show the result of your validation? So this is sort of a classic example from direct marketing, where you're trying to figure out who you should send mail to who's likely enough to respond. And by the way, these percentages on the response rates are kind of high. You typically don't get response rates that high for direct mail, but I didn't want to get into putting fractions of percentages on the scale. You've presumably got some sort of cutoff of response rates below which it's just not worth the cost of sending out the mail. So you've built some model and some data. You take data the model hasn't seen. You score the data. Now the scores predict probabilities in a lot of cases for every individual unseen observation, predicts the probability that you get a response for that. The only thing you use those probabilities for is to sort those observations. So you sort those observations and then you say, okay, well, in what the model said were the 10% that were most likely to respond, what was the actual response rate? So you're saying, if I only mail to the best 10%, what response rate can I expect? What if I mail to the best 20%? What response rate can I expect then? So the chart on the right is giving you those response rates. The chart on the left is showing you the multiplier effect, you know, how much better a response rate you're getting by just mailing to the top 10% or top 20% than if you'd mail to the entire population. So this is sort of the classic model validation chart that's been used in direct marketing since, you know, I'm sure 20, 30 years, and it's, you know, that's where a lot of this stuff started. This is something a little more like what you see in insurance. So again, the idea is you take unseen data, you apply the model to every observation to get a score, in this case a predicted loss ratio, And all you do with those predictions is use it to sort the data. Now, here, we typically plot the validation data and one other line. Now, in this case, the other line, I happen to have plotted the actual loss ratios on the training data. You could also plot the predicted loss ratios for the validation data, and it would tell you pretty much the same story. So here, so first of all, I guess I should be clear, whereas on the gains chart, each observation was the top 10%, the top 20%, the top 30%. Here we're looking at each decile separately, so it's the top, the first 10%, the second 10%, the third 10%, and so forth. Now what you want is you'd like these lines to lie on top of each other. That would be ideal. That would tell you that if your model says the worst performers have a loss ratio of 90 and the best performers have a loss ratio of 30, then you're actually, on unseen data, actually getting that much lift, that 3-to-1 lift. What this is saying is, well, it's not really quite true, because when you look at the validation data, the worst decile only has a loss ratio of 80 and the best decile has a loss ratio of about 35. So if you were to apply your model in practice, you might be overcharging some of the worst customers and undercharging some of the best customers. There's a couple of things you can do about that in practice. So one of them is you could simply say, okay, take the standard deviation of the of say the blue points, the standard deviation of the pink points. The standard deviation of the blue points is going to be larger because you've got more spread. So take the standard deviation of the pink points, divide it by the standard deviation of the blue points, maybe it's 0.8 or something. And then you could compress your scores, you know, by 20%. So things that used to be, you know, two customers that you were going to rate one at twice the rate of the other, you're now rating them at 1.8 times the rate of the other customer. So that's a fairly simple thing to implement. You know, another thing you could do that's a little tougher to implement is say, well, okay, and for most customers it looks like the model's doing fine, it's just the ones at the extremes where I'm either a little too high or a little too low. So you might just take, you know, say predictions over a 65 loss ratio or predictions lower than a 45 loss ratio and tweak them back, you know, a little bit towards the center. So although you don't ever want to refit your entire model after you've looked at the validation data, if when you do look at the validation data, you find out that your model was a little bit overfit, there are some practical things you can do about that will help. But you don't want to go back and refit the model, because if that was the last unseen data that you had, if you go back and refit another model, you're not going to be able to objectively test it now. One thing you can do, as long as you're willing to shrink the model back in one of the ways I just said, shrink the predictions, you could go back and fit the exact same model, you know, the exact same choice of variables and so forth, to all the data combined. In fact, for those of you in personal lines, that may be something you're going to be forced to do, because regulators may tend to look askance at a model that's only, the final model's only fit on part of the data. They may say, okay, well, how do I know that was a random sample? How do I know you didn't pick that to get an answer that you wanted? Yes? That's true. If you're doing out-of-time validation, then it's very important to add the most recent data back in. So this is, I guess, mostly for the people reading on the internet, because I think I probably just covered most of this. I'll just mention there's nothing magical about dividing into 10 pieces. If you've got very noisy data, you might be better off just dividing into 5 pieces. If you've got a very rich data set, you might want to divide into more pieces, like, for example, 20. Ventiles, I was easy. It's like that from the French because it's a lot easier to pronounce than Icosahiles, which would be from Greek, or Vigentiles, which would be from Latin. Although, just before the talk, Jim informed me that Kepler evidently used the term Vigentiles.
And modern astrologers.
Oh, okay. And evidently modern astrologers. So that's hopefully the lecture part of this about thou shalt do model validation. So the rest of this will be a little more fun. The various sort of other things you can do with the same ideas. So before we were talking about what do you do with the holdout data at the very end of everything. Now we're back in the training and test world. So the first part of this was largely for those of you who supervise people who are building models, how to make sure they are building models that work. You know, this is, you know, more for the people who build models, how you can use these ideas to build better models. So one thing is, how do you choose predictors? Now, I'm not talking about how you choose predictors for your final model, but sometimes you've got 200 or 300 variables you could use as predictors, and you want to narrow it down to a reasonable group before you even start any other process, because 300 predictors is a lot to deal with. So various things that you can do, you can divide the data into two, you know, model on each half, and say, okay, well, if it doesn't show up in both halves, if it doesn't show up as significant in both halves, I'm not going to use it. You can divide the data into a lot more than two pieces and use some sort of voting technique. So a lot of people, for example, will divide the data into five pieces, use some sort of regression tree on each piece, and say, okay, if a data element didn't show up in the regression trees on at least three of those five pieces, then I'm not going to use it. One thing that is also useful, maybe after you've done your first filtering of variables, is to split the data up by time or by geographic region. So you're probably interested in variables that have more or less the same effect from one year to the next, because that tends to increase your confidence that they'll have the same effect next year, which is when you really care about how well the model does. So a lot of times it's a good idea to split your data up by year, or if you don't have that much data, at least the first half of the time period covered by the data and the second half, and build models on both of them and see which variables act consistently between the, you know, have similar parameters between the two time periods. Another thing you might want to do, you know, you might want to take some strange state, you know, say New York versus the rest of the country. If you're interested in a model that's going to work countrywide, you probably want to focus on variables that work for the weird states too, and then maybe once you have that baseline, you might customize a little bit to New York or a little bit to the other states, but you might want to get that baseline first. Yeah, so another thing you can do is you can test the right type of model. So one of the problems with typical in-sample tests, you look at log likelihood, you look at AIC. That's great for nested models, but if you're using two different, completely different types of models, if you're using a GLM and a regression tree, you can't use anything like that to compare the two models. So you're left with nothing but take unseen data and see which does better on it. And this has a lot of advantages because When you're doing tests on in-sample data, you're stuck with statistical tests. You know, they've got all kinds of restrictions on when they can be used. They may not really be optimizing the thing you care the most about because they're tied to how you fit the model. When you look at out-of-sample data, you don't have to worry about any of that. You don't care how the model was built. All you care about is, on the out-of-sample data, which one does best, and you can define does best however you want. You're not constrained by what's in some statistics textbook. So if you think mean squared error is the definition of done best, great. If you think absolute error is the definition of done best, great. If you think that classifying a fraud as non-fraud is 10 times as bad as classifying a non-fraud as fraud, you can use that cost measure to test which model would cost you the least. So you can set it up however you want, and you get an objective test of which model is best for you. And again, I want to emphasize that if you do this, in order to get an objective measure of how well the model you picked worked, you still need that validation data that wasn't used for this comparison. Because otherwise you have the problem that's essentially equivalent to the winner's curse in bidding, that whichever one worked out the best on your test data, it's more likely than not that, you know, maybe it was a little bit overfit. You know, just like when you're bidding on an oil field, you know, everyone bids what they think it's worth. It's probably someone who is a little optimistic about how much it's worth is going to win the auction. So you always need one last check where you're only considering one model. So now, there are various compromises people do instead of believing the data 100%. You're all familiar with credibility, where you weight together the result for a state, for example, with the result countrywide. You know, there's various other, you know, statistical techniques that do similar things at various levels of sophistication. What this essentially does is you're using less than a full degree of freedom for each parameter. So, for example, in the credibility case, if you've got 50 states and you assign various credibilities to each state, the total, if you believed each state 100%, you'd have a model with 50 degrees of freedom. If you believe each state not at all, you have a model with 1 degree of freedom, if you use the global mean as the complement. If you have some other set of Zs, of credibilities for each state, the number of degrees of freedom of that model is basically, you know, it's essentially add up the Z's and then add something that's somewhere between 0 and 1 to that. So, for example, if every state were 50% credible, your model would have 25.5 degrees of freedom. So that should give you sort of an intuitive notion of what a fractional degree of freedom is. And, of course, you know, this isn't a lookup table where every single cell is credibility weighted to something else. There's some characteristics you're not going to want to use at all. But at the end of the day, is 25.5 degrees of freedom the right number of degrees of freedom? Is 10 better? Is 40 better? How do you want to decide that? So, we can talk about what model is the right size. So so the problem, it's well known, the problem with using log likelihood is that, well, as you add more parameters to the model, the log likelihood always gets better, because, you know, you get closer to the in-sample data the more parameters you add. So there's various information criteria that penalize that measure for the degrees of freedom that are supposed to provide an objective test of which model is the best model, what's the right complexity for the model. You know, the problem is, even if you're not in the situation we had before, where you're trying to compare things that are apples and oranges from a log likelihood point of view, a regression tree and a GLM model, even if you have nice nested models, and this is in some sense a legitimate comparison, you still have the problem that you really don't know the number of degrees of freedom to penalize, because it depends on how you did your search. So if you're just looking at a series of models from, you know, one variable, two variables, and so forth up to 20 variables, and that's the only series of models you're looking at, you know, it's probably okay to use AIC or BIC and, you know, then follow the penalty, you know, the appropriate penalty for the number of degrees of freedom. But that's not what anyone ever does. You're always looking at multiple models with the same number of degrees of freedom. So, for example, And if you use ordinary least squares, this isn't unreasonable to think that you might, you know, you don't want more than 8 features in your model. You've got 20 possible predictors. And you run, an ordinary least squares runs very fast. So you may run all 125,970 possible combinations of 8 of those 20 variables. Now, and you pick the one that fits best. Now, do you think the effective degrees of freedom of that is 8? Well, obviously, you have a lot more flexibility. Now, you also don't have 125,000 degrees of freedom because all these models are, by definition, have less chance of fitting the data well than one with all 20 features in it. But the effective number of degrees of freedom is probably closer to 20 than it is to 8. And the point is, even if you don't do this sort of automated search, everyone as part of the modeling process does some sort of model search. And presumably, if you're a good modeler, you're increasing the effective degrees of freedom more the better you are at modeling because you're probably searching more intelligently. And therefore, AIC is worse as a criterion. So this is why, you know, you can kind of pay attention to AIC and BIC as maybe a heuristic, but they're probably going to tell you to build more complex models than you really should. Significance tests kind of have the same problem, that they don't really apply when you're doing all the searching because significance tests are for one test, not for multiple testing. So to give you an example of something that actually was enough of a scandal that there was a talk about it at the Joint Statistical Meetings a couple years ago, in the medical field, and then this gives you an example where you need to worry about validation even if you're doing randomized trials. So in testing a drug, you do randomized trials. You say testing a drug for a certain kind of cancer. And you do randomized trials, and turns out it's not no significant benefit. Test group and control group results are too close together. So now you've sunk lots and lots of money into this research. So do you think the pharmaceutical company is likely to want to say, okay, we got to bag this and move on to the next thing? No. What they do is, okay, let's go back and look at other ailments that might have developed over the study period and see whether this drug is effective at preventing diabetes or preventing high blood pressure or preventing any of a number of ailments that it would be very lucrative to have a drug that, you know, another drug that helped with. Well, of course, you start testing for whether it prevents 20 or 30 or 40 diseases. One of those diseases is going to turn out to be significant at the 0.05 level because the definition of that significance test is you had a 1 in 20 chance of getting a false positive. So if you test 40 things, you've completely changed the value of the significance test. So this is why one of the reasons you've got to be very careful about significance tests when you're doing a model search. I didn't hear what you said. Yeah, I mean, if you're doing something in the medical situation I just described, yeah, you could use methods that control for multiple testing. Some of them are a little overly pessimistic. Some of them are a little overly they're not quite precise. But in the case where you're building complicated, more complex models, multiple regressions with interaction terms, there aren't going to be methods like that. So another problem is heteroscedasticity, which we'll get to in a minute. So let me, the rest of these slides have a lot of pictures in them, so I should be able to go through them fairly quickly. So the idea here, how do you find the right size model? Well, one idea is combine your training and test data, split it into a few pieces, and kind of simulate looking at holdout data by, say, if you divide it into 5 pieces, build a model on each 4/5 and see how it does on the other 1/5. So you have these 5 models, each built on 4/5 of the data. Every observation has exactly one model that never saw it. So for that observation, you look at that model's prediction and look at the error you have there, and you add it all up, and you get a prediction of how accurate that model is going to be. And then you can look at a series of models from less complex to more complex, and this will give you a more objective idea of which one's going to do best. So you can use this, for example, to figure out how many degrees of freedom you ought to have, figure out what a tuning parameter should be, such as K and Bayesian credibility. And let me give you a very simple example of where this can be useful. So this is some data. Some of you may notice an interesting characteristic of this data. I'll get to it in a minute if you haven't. And the question, suppose you kind of know this is supposed to be symmetric around the origin. So it looks kind of quadratic, and the question is, well, do you need next to the fourth term to fit it better? Or is just the parabola going to do well? And this is just a reminder that you probably don't want to go extrapolating these things beyond the range of the data. But that's sort of not relevant here because we are trying to stay within the range of the data. So if you were to fit regression models on that data, this is what you would get for the estimates of the parameters, what you would get for the standard deviations of those estimates, and then the p-values is just significance. So that coefficient for the x to the fourth term is significant. It's significant at the 0.01 level. It's significant at the 0.005 level. This is saying that if you didn't need that x to the fourth term, there's less than one chance in 300 that you would have gotten a coefficient this big. So it's saying you probably need that term. Well, something a little hinky about that data. If you go back here, you may notice that the observations in the middle cluster a lot better than the observations around the ends. That's called heteroscedasticity. You probably don't look for this problem in your data. You make an assumption about variance structure, which it's the same for any observation. If you're doing linear regression, it follows some simple function of the predicted mean if you're doing a GLM. You probably never test that assumption. And it's in some ways legitimate that you don't test it because your predictions and the parameter estimates may not be terribly sensitive to it, but what's a lot more sensitive to it are the standard deviations of the parameter estimates and the significance tests. So this can throw your significance tests way off. So now suppose you did just threefold cross-validation on this data. So this is, I'm taking a third of the data, and these are the quartic polynomial and the parabola are fed on the other two-thirds of the data. And you were to look at the sums of squared errors for this plot and do it twice more, so you have every observation, you've looked at the sum of squared errors when you use one of the models that didn't see it. You add all that up. So what we get, if we're looking at the sum of squared errors for the full model, obviously the quadratic can't fit as closely as the quartic. But if we look for the threefold cross-validation at the sum of squared errors, they're the same. So when we're looking at out-of-sample data, that fourth power term isn't helping at all. Now, you may be a little suspicious how many times I tried to generate this data to get that 0.003, 6 times. So a 1 in 300 event, I tried to generate the data set 6 times to get that extreme of p-value. The reason is I put heteroscedasticity into the model, which completely blows the significance test out of the water. Now, another reason, don't put too much faith in the standard deviations that come out of the models. You want to do cross-validation whenever you can. So this is just a simplified notion of what property casualty data looks like. This isn't meant to be a lesson on how to do modeling. This is just, you've got a few extreme observations, but they're the ones you really care about. You divide the data into the pink and the blue and fit regression lines to each of them. You probably can't see the regression lines, but that magnifies it a little bit. So you can see you'd have very different predictions depending on which half of the data set you were looking at. You might say, well, one half of it, oh, you know, looks like whatever X variable I'm plotting, it doesn't really affect losses at all. And the other one, you might say, gee, it looks like it has a really big impact on losses. Now, obviously, I'm oversimplifying things here. But my main point is it looks like that's a lot of data points. But it really isn't, because there's only a few that are important. So a lot of times we kid ourselves when we think that we have these really huge data sets that we can do anything with. In fact, we've got a few observations that can really drive things. So we need to be very careful about how complex we make the models, or they will go to school on those few observations a little more than we want. So some quick points. Out of sample tests are easier because you don't need to worry about fussy statistical assumptions. They have common sense interpretations because you can define, you know, your cost function in terms of dollars. It doesn't have to follow some theory. That makes it a lot easier to present the results to management. You know, and finally, one thing I haven't really talked about, though Jim alluded to it, is sometimes if you have data that are highly correlated within the same time period, you really need your holdout data to be from a different time period and not just unseen observations. So you need to do anything. You need to eliminate any correlations between the unseen data and the seen data. So one last thing I wanted to mention. One thing I found out as I've been talking to a lot of people in banking, mainly because a lot of people in banking seem to want jobs at insurance nowadays, is that in the last couple of years, regulators have been requiring a lot of our banks, when they're modeling, say, customer credit worthiness, to have an independent model validation team that's sort of at arm's length from their modeling group to make sure they're not making mistakes or fitting over optimistic models. The question, since the regulation of banking and the regulation of insurance are in some ways not so far apart, is this something that's going to come to us? Is this something where the CAS should be proactive and come up with some standards for how we ought to validate models? Because hopefully when I talked about how many times I redrew that data set to come up with the 0.003 significance level for that one parameter, you started thinking about, well, you know, that there's a lot of funny things you can do to make a model look better than it is or look worse than it is. Do we need, and you can do them accidentally. I'm not just talking about intentionally. Do we need some standards on setting aside data at the start of a project? Do we need standards about when that needs to be from a different guidance on when that needs to be from a different time period? And, you know, and it would have to address some practical issues, too. So, for example, there's a lot of data quality stuff you can't do after you've split off the validation data. You can no longer balance to financials, for example, to make sure you have a complete data set. So, obviously, there's some things you need to do before you split the data into pieces. And then, finally, a quick list of references. I'll just mention the last two. So cross-validation is an example of a resampling method. Bootstrapping is also an example. Davison and Hinckley is probably the best bootstrapping reference there is. They even talk about bootstrapping for GLM specifically. It doesn't seem to be very widely known, so I thought I would mention it. And Walter's book on variance estimation is the same ideas in a completely different context, understanding interpreting the results of surveys, which is an example. So a lot of the validation work comes from the machine learning community. Walter's book is an example of validation work that's been around for a very long time in the very classical statistical community. So it's really important. And both groups recognize how important this is. Let me switch this over to Paul's slides. With that, I'll turn it over to Paul.
Uh, Whatever you're not supposed to do, you're not supposed to do it again. I thought I'd look at the question of how well do GLMs fit in context of validation and what we can do to validate GLMs and what kind of measures we can put in place in order to see how well they fit, given that we have procedures for fitting GLMs. So that's really what it's about. So this agenda is about talk a little bit about validation. We're going to use two sample portfolios here. They're both US portfolios. One's an automobile private passenger auto portfolio. They're both reasonably small portfolios, so they're for smaller companies, but this will exist in lots of places, you know, in the United States. As I said, one's a personal auto portfolio, and we're just looking at the collision coverage part of that. So it's one homogeneous piece of that, and the other one's a homeowner's portfolio. Again, not very large. What we want to do is we want to fit some frequency GLMs to these two particular portfolios. We want to do that because they, you know, everybody knows severity GLMs just fit like crap. So that's no point talking about that and then saying, well, look at the validation statistics. So let's just fit frequency ones because they fit a bit better. We're just going to use the standard type of assumptions that people use, which is as a Poisson error structure and a log link function, pretty simple. In other words, we want to measure the GLM from a position of strength and see how well it does if we keep aside validation data. We want to then look at some indicators of fit. I want to talk briefly about statistical inference and what people mean by statistical inference and what I think is the problem with that, and we then look at validation as an indicator of fit. And I want to look at validation in terms of these particular frequency of GLMs in another way by using general iteration algorithms, which is there's a reference to a paper in here by a couple of people who I thought did very particularly good work, and finally some conclusions at the end. So in terms of validation data, the simple definition applies. It's a data set kept aside, you know, from the modelling. What we want to test for is model generalisation and model prediction. Remember, this is about predictive modelling, so it involves prediction. We need to test that the prediction is actually reasonable or not. The other thing is all models overfit. It's a matter of by how much. You need to be happy with by how much this model overfits. So we want to measure how well the model does. The general rule we're going to use here is we're going to keep two-thirds of the data for training and a third for validation. That's just a general rule. I'm not an actuary, I'm a computer scientist. That's a general rule that we tend to use. So that's what we're going to use. The other thing that leads me to the suspicion about this validation stuff is that the Bayesians think that they have a method for finding the very best model just given training data, that they don't need the validation data. So they have the probability of the models being right. They have competing models. So when we talk about maximum likelihood and stuff, they tend to smirk at us. So there's a scepticism there which makes me think, well, maybe there's something to this. So let's do validation and find out. As I said, the first portfolio is a small personal auto one. It's about 40,000 years of exposure per annum. It's about 4,000 claims per annum, which is a higher frequency. Remember, this is just collision frequency. It's higher than most. These guys really know how to drive their cars into things, mostly. So what we want to do is we want to fit the best GLM we can on some training data. And in this particular case, we want to explore just the main effects GLM. So we're not going to using all the combinations of all the variables. In other words, so we wrote our own software to do this, to test this out. We're going to use a chi-squared for inclusion of extra variables. So we're going to build up a whole tree of all the different combinations of variables that we can put into this thing. We'll use a common design matrix, so these are all nested GLMs, and what we'll do is we'll optimise a deviance given that it passes a chi-squared test for inclusion. Pretty simple stuff, really. We'll use 2 years for training, and the last year for validation. So I've got 3 years of data here, so we'll use 2 years training, and we'll try to predict what the last year says. So here's some model statistics that come out of the best GLM we can fit by this particular procedure that we have. And you can see there's some sexy-looking numbers here. We've got some great-looking p-values. Z-values are kind of okay. You can see the standard error is a little wide, but remember, it's a small portfolio. People are used to seeing minuscule standard errors, but perhaps you deal with larger portfolios than this. We calculated some other measures down here which I think are kind of interesting, and you'll notice the second bottom one is Efron's pseudo R squared. And we know that That's got a really strange number. It's a weighted value. It's calculated through the design matrix, and it's basically the square of the difference between the actual and the estimate versus divided by the square of the difference between the actual and the average of the actuals and the mean. So it's 1 minus all that thing. So it's a kind of an R-squared measure, and it's really low for a model that's got such good p-values. I would have expected to do better than this out of this thing. The AIC and BIC, it's just the way we calculate it out of this model, that's all. It just depends on which calculation you put into here. This one follows the STATA, S-T-A-T-A, example, the calculations that are in there. R calculates it differently, for instance. SAS calculates it differently. There's a number of differences between all these things. This compares... the model statistics versus the same statistics when we run the validation data through that same, through the beta values that are fitted by that model. Now we can see, I think, the deviance is double, even though I've got kind of half the data, but it's not really comparable because they're not linearly comparable, really. The EFRON's gone negative for some reason. So for some reason, when I look at the independent data, this thing does worse than just using the mean, even though I got pretty reasonable sort of model statistics out of it. Why is the validation data so bad? So having the validation data aside already gives me some clue as to there's something wrong with my model. Had I not had this validation data, I've just got the model statistics to convince myself. So when you look behind this, there's a frequency drift between the years. So in other words, our validation data contains a different frequency, underlying frequency, than our training data. So we can attempt to put another variable inside of the model, which is the year, the exposure year that we're using. But what we're actually going to do is fix this up by splitting the data 2/3 to 1/3 at random. We're just going to randomise the selection so all this frequency drift thing will go away, and we're going to refit the models. And here's another sexy model. Again, it's got great-looking p-values, good-looking z's. The EFRON's not real great either on this model, though. We didn't seem to do much better. When we split the data in two and we use the same procedure for fitting the model, I just don't feel confident about this model somehow. And when I look at the validation data, we find that the deviance is now better on the validation data than it is on the training data. So at least now I've got something which I think, if I use the normal measures, I'm kind of happy with that. You know, I've got less data, but it's actually lower. But the EFRON's got even closer to zero. It's about half of what the other one was. What's going on with this EFRON measure? So is this model good or not, is the real question. It had good model statistics. We've got all the indicators seem to be okay, but it only does... The conclusion from the EFRON thing, and I know it has normality assumptions in it, but the conclusion is it doesn't do much better than the mean, really, in fitting this data. So if the deviance is a measure of validation accuracy, then as part of fitting iteratively lots of models to get this one as the best one, the one that had the lowest deviance on the validation data is actually a much simpler model than this one completely. But that's a different measure. That's the measure of the deviance on the validation data, and that points to something else. But that particular model had a worse deviance on the training data. So it's a trade-off between how well we fit the training data and how well we fit the validation data, as it always is. This indicates that this model is overfitting to some considerable degree. So let's look at, can we devise a measure that tells me something about the degree to which the model actually works? So we want a relative measure that uses the Poisson error structure that's inherent inside of these models, that's deviance-based, but that we can use to compare different models. In other words, training to validation. So the simplest measure we have is the relative improvement in the deviance, which is 1 minus the deviance of the model over the deviance of the null model. So that's an indication of how powerful the model is in deviance terms in relation to the null model. So if I look at this model again, I find that the improvement in deviance in these terms over the null model for the training data is 7.5%. It's not much better than just fitting the mean, really. This model may have great p-values and stuff, but it doesn't do much better. It's supportive of what that EFRON number that has normality assumptions in it was kind of saying. The validation data, the improvement in deviance is only 3.2%. So less than half the signal that's present in the training data is actually in the validation data. So this model overfits quite substantially. The question is it just this portfolio? Have I just got a weird portfolio? That could very well happen. So this is a homeowner's portfolio. This is about kind of 9,000 claims a year, and we have 2 years of data. We're going to use 1 year for training and the subsequent year for validation. So this is a pretty simple example. I've just split it year by year. Again, I can't show all the values because there are a lot of these that would just get like a silly little table. It has some good p-values, very significant z-values. We've got a much better EFRON this time. So this looks like it's a candidate for something anyway. And again, it looks like a good model, and I'm heartened by the EFRON measure. When I look at the validation data from this model, remember this model is generated by iteratively going through all the variables and adding them only if they pass the chi-squared test and only if they drive the deviance down. So if we follow that procedure, what happens in this case is when we look at the validation performance, the EFRON's actually got negative. This looks like something is dramatically wrong with this model because the mean would do much better than this. If we look at our deviance improvement measure, we find that the model does, it drives the deviance down 49% over the null model, but on validation, the deviance is worse than the null model. So that's the same kind of measure as we had out of the EFRON thing. So it's a catastrophe is really the conclusion out of this model. There's no other way of stating this. Again, by having the validation data, I can look into why it's a catastrophe, and it happens to be a catastrophe because one variable passes all the tests for inclusion and it has different distributions from year to year. It's a catastrophic variable. So the fitted model, the model statistics don't show this. It's only by validation that you show this. So if we take... Well, here's another measure. We've spoken about Gini and Gaines charts. If I look at this model that fits like crap, the Gini on the training data is 0.29 and the Gini on the validation data is 0.24. If you were using Gini to see if this model worked, you'd say it was pretty good. So there's a problem with using Gini. The real problem with using Gini is Gini measures lift. It doesn't measure fit. So this is a divergent view to the other statistics that we had. Why is this the case? If we have these two models, you can see one fits much better than the other, but they both have about the same Gini score. That looks like what we have. So Gini score or Gaines charts or any of those measures that do these kind of cumulative things tend to show that these models work. Same as if you break this into deciles, it would tend to show that this model kind of worked. The real problem is it fits badly, and it's a fit measure that's the problem. It's not the gain of the thing. So if I take the problem variable out of this model, and I can only do that because I've got the validation data, now I get a new model, which you can see now I've got an EFRON of 0.6 something. So now I've got an R-squared that starts to look like an R-squared that we're kind of familiar with, that we get some comfort from out of this. And the R-squared on validation is also much more reasonable now. Now we've taken the problem variable out. The other interesting thing is the deviance improvement now 75% for the training data. So it does much better than the null model. It drives the deviance down right down. And the deviance improvement for the validation data is 58%. So this looks like, in ordinary parlance, this looks like a real model for a change, other than the things we were looking at before. This does much better than the mean. But the model statistics are no better than the previous model statistics, right? If we just looked at those and didn't have validation data, we'd never know any of this stuff, really. The other thing about this is this consistently overfits. You can see it loses about 25% of the signal on validation. So that's quite a large loss out of this signal. If we think that a deviance improvement measure is the measure of how powerful the model is, it's about 25% less powerful in terms of generalisation than it was on the training data. So we can see that models overfit all the time. Why do they do this? Well, if you talk to the Bayesians, they would say, well, of course it does this. If you're using maximum likelihood, that's only just better than squared error. So they're very scathing about using maximum likelihood. So Maybe it can only arise from the methodology. We've kind of got two different data sets. It can't both be so problematic that it just shows this problem as a matter of chance. It doesn't look like it. Maybe there's a problem with the methodology where we're using maximum likelihood, and the Bayesians kind of indicate that. Maybe it's a Poisson error structure. Maybe it's not really right for doing frequency-type models. Maybe it's a log-link function. Maybe the multiplicative models that come out of this aren't really good. So the question is, can we relax some of these assumptions and can we get better models that come out of this if we relax some of these assumptions? So if we use the work of this paper of Peter Wu and Fuyang Liu of generalised iteration algorithms, if we encode these in, we can iterate through these P, Q and K parameters, and they can look at a lot of intermediate values of distributions and link functions to fit this data. So they propose a number of measures for measuring how well the model fits. You can get all these out of their paper. I just happen to reproduce them here. It really means you need to pick one of these measures because they're not common with any of the measures that are in the GLMs. So you can pick one of these measures to decide which model fits better. One of these GIAs, one of the iterations, one of the P, Q and K values will be the familiar GLM with the log link and the Poisson error structure. You'll get exactly the same values out of this as you got out of the GLM. So what we want to do is measure these using the same design matrix that we use for the GLM, essentially. So everybody gets the same design matrix and gets these values computed in the same way. So if we go back to our automobile example where we had the collision coverage and we split the data two-thirds, one-third at random, and we used the same variables as the best GLM we could fit to that thing, and we feed them into this iterative GIA, we're going to run 632 different GIAs by probing P, Q and K values. So we find if we use the first measure, the GLM is the second best. Looks like there's only one GIA that beats the GLM in terms of performance on the validation data. So it's WAB, performance on the validation data, that we're using as the measure. If we use WAQB, the GLIM is only 400th out of the list of 600 different models that we can fit on this data, if that's our measure of fit on the validation data. Again, if we use a chi-squared test of fit, then the GLIM's about 400th again. So there's a lot better combinations of P, Q and K in this general iteration algorithm that lead to better solutions that validate much better than GLMs do in this case. The other thing that you find from this, if you look at some of these GIAs that come out, the best ones that come out for these particular measures, you find that the relativities can be quite different from the relativities that we calculate using the GLM with our familiar parameter settings. In the case of the homeowner's portfolio, again, we've run the same test with exactly the same variables as we ended up with when we were talking about GLMs, and we find that depending on which measure we use, this one, the GLM doesn't perform as catastrophically badly on some of the other measures as it did on the previous portfolio, but it's not the best measure. It's not the best out of any of these. Again, even when it's seventh best, the relativities can be quite different in this particular case than those calculated by the GLM. In terms of the generality of the results that we've had, we've used this on larger data sets. We find the same kind of thing occurs all the time. GLMs, using this procedure of driving the deviance down and including variables only when the chi-squared test warrants their inclusion, leads to an overly specific model that overfits the data quite substantially. We've also found the same problem in experiments where GLMs are fitted by consulting actuaries. They tend to overfit quite substantially. We think that this is an attribute of the methodology and not of the data. We've done enough tests on different data sets now that it seems to be an attribute of, as the Bayesians say, maximum likelihood is going to overfit. And that's just because that's the methods that we're using. It doesn't seem to be an attribute of the analyst fitting the data, even though I and my colleagues fitted these particular GLIMs. We've had GLIMs fitted by consulting actuaries that have the same issues involved when we do validation externally to these measures. So in conclusion, model statistics can be misleading, can be very misleading. The power of validation is we have an external measure of how well this thing does. and it's not based on model statistics. There are comments made. I have a friend who's an actuary who made a comment, but we don't keep validation data aside because we're doing statistical inference. In other words, we're trying to get the best values for the parameters that we possibly can that describe the population. Well, I think that's okay, but you're not getting very good values in terms of prediction. And if we're doing predictive analytics, it's the prediction that we're really interested in, is a power to predict unseen data. So hiding behind the fact that we're doing statistical inference, we can overlook the fact that we over-specify models. So it seems like the GLM assumptions don't appear to be optimal, that we've seen the process can lead to overfitting. We've also seen that through these general iteration algorithms, that there are other processes in place which create models that tend to fit the data better than the standard GLM does. My suspicion is that the maximum likelihood is the real problem here. The real reason is the log likelihood surface is very shallow. It's a very shallow bowl. And so we've got methods that climb the bowl of the log likelihood surface. And because it's so shallow, the actual peak of the bowl is so flat that the idiosyncrasies in the data tend to pull it around slightly from place to place. And just pulling it around a little bit can create very different results in terms of parameter values that come out of the GLM itself. So for small changes in log likelihood, we can get very different values of betas out of this thing. So the maximum of the surface is... we're not immune to the squared error problem. We've just got a different version of it, essentially, I think. These models overfit, as all models overfit. The only way to find this is have validation data. Or the only way to get around it is go back to the Bayesians and attempt to use their methods, which, believe me, are not simple to use. And that's it, I think. Thank you.
Are there any questions for our panelists?
I don't think you could ever have a test that's as good as looking at, for example, a test data, because you're always going to have noisy data. You're always going to have cases where a variable looks great on one half of the data, no matter what technique you're using, and on the other half of the data, it just falls apart. So, and it's always a problem. In fact, I think, I think, and Paul can correct me if I'm wrong, I would suspect that a lot of the reason that when he builds models sort of in an automatic way that just use chi-square and then they validate poorly, that it's a lot of it has to do with the chi-square test allowing features into the model that just shouldn't be there, which is why I was suggesting when you're building the model, to split the training and test data up into a bunch of pieces before you even look at the validation data and use some sort of voting technique to make sure you've got consistency in how a particular variable that you want to include in the model, make sure it's consistent in how it acts on different parts of the data set. And if it's wildly inconsistent between how it works for this year and how it works for that year, you just don't want that variable because it's going to mess up your model.
I'd agree with that. The chi-square test certainly does let a lot of stuff into the model. The only other thing I'd say is the best models, given a number of variables, given n variables that you chose, the best models, as indicated by these general iteration algorithms, are never the GLM. There's always some other model which is in between that actually fits the data up better and ends up generalising better and performing better on the validation data. So that it's a complex... Given our model, the chi-square test puts too many things in it, but given a piece of data that we want to actually find the best model is usually never the GLM.
Can I ask a follow-up question for that, Paul? I wasn't following all the details, but I mean, it seems like you're not using out-of-sample lift as the measure of quality, were you, when you compare the GIA to the GLM models, or were you?
No, I'm using the four measures that were quoted in the paper. So that's why you get four different ranks for the GLM out of the 600.
Right.
models right. that are produced by the iterative GIAs.
Right. I mean, that itself is that the fact that you have four different measures and those measures tell different things, and they're all and sometimes they even disagree with out of sample lift. That kind of goes back to your question about, like, is there some general reason why you need out-of-sample data? It's like, I don't think anybody's come up with, like, a theory. You know, there's no one generally accepted theory for doing a model validation in sample. There are all these different measures. There's AIC, BIC. And, you know, they all try to attempt at approximating what an out-of-sample validation would look like if you had it. So, and sometimes you need that. If you're doing some kind of, like, a very small pharmaceutical thing and the data is very precious, you really might, or if you're doing loss reserving, if you just don't have out-of-sample data, you might need that, an AIC or BIC type approach. But if you have enough data, I think you always want to do out-of-sample.
I'd say if you have small data set, walk away. Go do something else.
that's actually what Nassim Taleb would say.
The performance was based on the holdout set, not on the training data.
So, granted, you take any 632 days, there's one that's fast.
Yep.
Does that hold on an independent set? Or do you find that the GIAs are so similar that one GIA might fit fast on this set and another one might fit fast on another random subset?
In other words, if you have two validation
right.
sets, how
right.
support the random.
That was your comment about the three-part, right?
Yep. So we haven't done that test. That, given the amount of time I can spend messing around with things, I haven't spent the time messing around with that one. But very interestingly, between the two portfolios, between the private passenger collision portfolio and the homeowner's one, the actual PQ and K values for the best GIAs for given measures were quite different. So they had different parameter values, so it looks like there are different shape distributions underneath there. And that's probably what they respond to. How much they overfit, that's another matter. That's right. And that's what the heart of your question.
Okay.
Just a question. I got a slight concern about drawing too many broad conclusions about the use of GLM in this context, because the example there did focus on the use of chi-square tests as the basic primitive in my expert, which is what a lot of people get over excited about practice. And I'm not aware of any practitioner that would really rely on the test when doing a model there. I think what a lot of people would do is use more pragmatic tests, such as interacting each factor in turn with time or the random factor and looking at the consistency. So sort of almost moving towards an outside test on the sample data. I guess what would really interest me is not how GLM sort of is in that automated way, which doesn't really go purchase or whatever on practice. What would interest me is have you looked at sort of properly manually crafted GLM and how that compares.
We've done those tests where we've had other people craft those GLMs, people who do GLMs all the time, yeah, and we've kept aside some validation data, and it doesn't do very well on validation data. But and I think it's the process of, as I say, the people who study Bayes techniques will tell you that maximum likelihood overfits. They snigger at this stuff. And I suspect there's something behind that, because every model overfits, but maximum likelihood overfits perhaps more than we traditionally thought it overfitted. And I think it's the problem is the surface is so shallow.
Can I ask a follow-up question to that? I actually agree with you philosophically. I'm kind of philosophically a Bayesian myself. And I mean, yesterday in my hierarchical models thing, I was alluding to shrinkage and things like that. And Christopher, you were alluding to shrinkage too. When you're taking an out-of-sample data set and say you have that 0.8 differential, you use that as kind of a homemade shrinkage factor. I think that's an extra smart idea. Is there any reason to think a Bayesian would like the GIA iterative technique any better than maximum likelihood, or are you just drawing a comparison?
No. I try to draw a comparison between two things. First of all, I think you need validation data. If we're going to make a scientific comparison, there's no test other than independent validation data. The other thing was that inherent in the GLMs are some assumptions about distributions and stuff. And the way to test that is to try things that relax those assumptions, which is why I tried the GIAs. Mm-hmm. The Bayesians would say that they follow a different method in finding the best model. They think they can find the most probable model. but they look at the probability of the model, which is actually a graph, given a data set D. So they think they can maximise the probability of the graph given a data set D. But that, as I say, the methods for doing that are very convoluted, involve an inordinate amount of computing resource to resolve. They're all these Monte Carlo...
MCMC.
Markov chain Monte Carlo methods, like Metropolis Hastings sampling and millions of iterations of that. But they get robust models for the small problems that they've solved so far.
Any other questions? No? Well, let's give some more validation to our panelists.
Yeah, it's because I come from a different field.
Yeah.